It's time for Let's Talk Money.
Good afternoon, Chad McGee. You're listening to Let's Talk Money with Jim Place and Jamie O'Donnell. 267-1023 is our number. We start on market day. Dow Jones average sits at 18,344 points, down 229. S&P at, 5,806, down 44. Co-hosting with me this afternoon, Stephanie Pettigo from Shambliss & Bonner. Stephanie, how are you?
I'm well, thanks, Jim.
All right, thanks for having me. You and I today. Max, how are you doing?
I'm doing good.
You be nice to this lady, Max.
I'll try to be nice.
Thanks, Max.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, Steph, we're going to talk about estate planning today because that's what you do for a living.
It is indeed.
And first off, I tell those people, I've told people for years that I thought the Shambliss Law Firm, maybe originally, I guess, under the direction of Dana Perry and ultimately her and Greg Willard, made a decision a long time ago that estate planning was going to be a key component to what they did. And I told you before the show started today that I think there were a lot of law firms that really didn't think of estate planning as a money-making operation and wasn't central to what they do. Shambliss went an entirely different direction, didn't they?
They did.
I mean, they really built a whole staff, a unit around the idea of estate planning.
Yes, we did. And we're really proud of that. And I think, you know, the drive of that was, how do we serve the community well? And I think you've got to have depth. You've got to have a lot of experience. You've got to have commitment and vision that way. Dana Perry was instrumental, is still instrumental in that vision, and Greg Willard. And we've got 9 attorneys that are dedicated to doing estate planning and estate administration. We have a concept of wanting to wrap care around our clients. And so we have social workers that we've hired that are there at Shambliss that assist families as needed, as we're asked. But we're able to really really help a family just all the way around.
How'd you choose the estate planning arena? So, I mean, you're going to law school. I mean, you could have chose what?
Any
numerous different avenues.
Absolutely. So my grandparents did some interesting estate planning. They had a family limited partnership, and that was just an interesting thing to me. And so that kind of led me to have some conversations with our estate planning professor, and then that led me to just individual study with her, and just enjoyed it.
All right, let's go through the process for a minute. I think a majority of the time when I'm talking with people that are clients or potential prospects or whatever, and we get down and we talk about, they don't tend to use the term estate planning. They tend to say, I don't have a will.
That's right.
There is a will out there if you don't have a will, isn't there?
Yes, sir, there is.
What is it called?
It is called the Laws of Intestacy, or the Tennessee Code Annotated,
in
where
essence,
they're found.
They will decide for you, won't they?
Absolutely, they will.
And in numerous situations, when they decide for you, you think you know something, you pass away, and what you thought you know, you didn't know. You gave me a perfect example of that.
That's right. That's right. So, that's what gets us every time, right? We talked about that you, what you think you know, and you don't.
I mean,
that's
you,
what hurts.
You have a husband, a wife, 2 adult children.
Right. And so the assumption is, well, of course, if I pass away, everything's going to go to my husband.
Or goes to my wife, yeah.
Or wife, right. Whoever's passed away first, we're thinking surviving spouse gets it. That is not what...
That's not what the state of Tennessee intestate law says.
It does not at all. So what the intestate laws say is that, in that example, if we've got 2 adult children or 2 children and a surviving spouse is going to get 1/3 of the estate.
And the children are going to get the other 2/3.
That's right.
And you might say, well, then the children, conceivably, if they knew what their parent wanted, they could disclaim it, but there's an entire legal process that goes with that. And God forbid that that's a blended family where one of the kids that's been left 1/3 of the money, it's not his mother or his father that's left.
That's right.
And he or she wants their money.
That's right. That's right. And it happens. So I've done this. I've administered estates where this is exactly what happened. Even biological children, certainly, I mean, it's their money and it's their right to keep it, and period. So if they want to be generous and they want to you know, disclaim their interest. They certainly can, and we help families do that. It's a process. And of course, you know, if the family had come in to see us before and we had put into place what they thought was going to happen, which is if I pass away first, everything's going to my spouse, this was a whole lot easier. That could have been a whole
lot. Because you end up in a situation where I think people would tell you that have been involved with this process or do it like you do for a living is having to fix yourself after the fact.
Right.
Is significantly more expensive than fixing it on the front end.
That's right. More expensive in every way. So, of course, just money. Yes, it's going to cost a lot more for us to go back and make sure all those, get the disclaimers, make that all correct, to probate or to deal with the intestate estate in court. That's going to cost a lot more than that planning would have cost on the front end. What's also going to cost a lot is what the family feels like. And so there's a lot of emotion that comes, you know, after someone's passed away, someone that we love. And unfortunately, if even if there was the best intentions and it was just an accident and planning just wasn't done for whatever reason, I've still seen families hurt because it feels like the loved ones weren't taken care of. And so that cost is high, too.
The emotional cost is high.
Exactly.
As well as the potential financial repercussions that
exactly.
come from it. Let's go through the process of I need a will and or I need some level of estate planning done. If I got a lot of money, I'll call it estate planning if I don't have I don't have anything. And maybe Jim or Jamie is my financial advisor or something. I mentioned to them, I need to get a will. How does the process work from the very get-go?
Right. So from the very get-go, someone calls me and says, I need a will. What do we do first? Well, we're going to need to gather information, to be able to understand that person, that family, and help them. So the first information we're going to get is just this demographic. Who are you? Who's your family?
There's going to be a questionnaire. And normally that questionnaire, somebody in your office is going to email that questionnaire to the potential prospect or client.
Exactly. So one questionnaire is going to be kind of personal information that way. Another questionnaire is going to be financial information. And so we're going to ask for kind of what are your liquid accounts? What real property do you have? Investments? And we'll get
you
that.
You literally want to know everything from an asset standpoint, and you also are going to want to know, and that you're going to have to take a time as an individual filling out this paperwork, how it's titled. What do I own? How do I own it?
Exactly. And essentially, we need to know how is it owned?
Yes.
Right. Because that's going to direct, of course, how is it going to flow? Because a lot of people think, well, if I put it in my will, if I said my house is going to my son, that's going to rule, and that's what's going to happen. Well, that's not going to happen if my house is owned jointly with someone else. My will is not going to control. It's my house is not going to my son.
No, the titling is going to control it, just like a beneficiary form is going to control. Most people don't really think about the fact that when you sign a beneficiary form, it's literally contract law.
It is.
So the money that's assigned in that beneficiary form to somebody never, ever even hits the will.
That's right. Exactly, Jim.
So if you've left a beneficiary form, if you've left your ex-wife on that thing for 15 or 20 years, she's getting the money.
That's right.
And your existing wife is not going to be damn happy about that.
Not one bit.
And or your children or whatever the case would be in a blended family out there. So, I mean, I tell people all the time, we potentially hurt ourselves when we don't know what we don't know. You can be the most skilled individual in the world at what it is you do. You can be the best brain surgeon. Doesn't make you an estate attorney. And I don't want you doing brain surgery on me.
I would never presume to.
Yeah, it wouldn't be close. It wouldn't be. If you wanted a financial advisor, I'm a good person to talk to. If you want somebody to pick a football game for you, I'm a little shaky. I'm going to miss them. So in essence, as we're looking through this process, you're beginning to gather all of this information.
That's right.
And it may be if it happens to be a client of ours, we'll actually send the investment information of the things that we control. But we we may not have any control over the 401k, or there may be other assets out there. There may be real estate out there. You're looking for it all.
That's right. And you do a great job. So we always appreciate
But at that point, depending on who you're getting, you as a client, if you want the best result for this process, you've got to give Stephanie, Dana, Greg, whoever it would be, all of the information.
That's right. Yeah. What we don't know will hurt you. So if I don't know the whole picture, I can't help you fully. And it could be really catastrophic to your planning.
No, I'll tell you what, we'll take a break and come back. 267-1023, Let's Talk Money. We'll be right back.
Let's Talk Money. Talk Radio 102.3.
You're back on Let's Talk Money, 267-1023. This with me this afternoon, Stephanie Pettigo from Shambliss Bonner, Stoffel, and...
That's it.
Okay. Now, all right, so we're talking about the process of the estate planning process. You're getting the questionnaire. Now I'm going to come in. We filled out the questionnaire. We've gotten all the information to you. We're going to come in and we'll sit down and we're going to have a meeting.
That's right. And I'm going to explain to you kind of here's a first consideration we need to make is we need to understand that there's a couple of ways we can go. There's a will-based plan. There's a trust-based plan. Both are good plans, but we're going to talk about kind of what your specific situation is and your desires, how your property is held, and we're going to think about what is the most efficient planning for you that's comprehensive and achieves the goals.
Goals you want to achieve.
That's right.
And it really doesn't matter to you what direction you go.
No.
I mean, that's really a matter. And there are times when you could accomplish the goal and objective one way versus the other, couldn't you?
That's
it's not
right.
always clearly defined.
That's right. That's right. So so when we think about kind of a will-based plan for someone, then we're thinking about, are we okay with kind of waiting until someone's passed away for this planning to come into place? Are we going to be able to control most assets by beneficiary designation or joint ownership, such that we feel confident that to the extent there's a need to probate, it's not very great.
I think a perfect example would be that I had a widow in here the other day. We were looking at her situation and we were sending her over to Shambliss. But it was a situation where she had a pretty significant amount of money in an IRA.
Right.
Was all passing by beneficiary form.
Right.
She had fairly substantial amount of money in the bank. It was set up POD, payable on death, with a beneficiary form. About the only thing left to go through probate was going to be personal assets and the house.
There you go. Yeah.
And that's kind of will-based, isn't it?
That's a perfect example of when we think this seems like a great idea for a will-based plan. Some things that we'd check would be, did that family have, or does that family have within it, someone with maybe a special need? And if so, then maybe we need to look and see, do we need to put some planning within the will to take care of that person? Or do we need to pivot and kind of look at a trust-based plan?
All right, so I look at a will-based plan. Let's say I give you the same alternative that I gave you a minute ago. I've got the same lady in there. It's all going by beneficiary form, except her only beneficiary is her son, who's a brain surgeon.
All right. So we would think about, well, he's probably doing well, such that we're not going to worry so much about does he have a special need or kind of on that end of the spectrum.
What
we are going to think about is that he is in a high risk profession.
He could get sued.
Yes, sir. That's right. And so what we want to do is we want to protect assets for him. And the best way we could do that is to leave assets in trust.
Now you just took the same situation. You made one little wrinkle to it and it just move from a will-based plan to a trust-based plan.
That's right. And to be fair, there's kind of a hybrid a bit too. So what we could also consider a will-based plan that then distributes in trust to the brain surgeon's son. But most likely in that situation, we would begin with a trust-based plan such that the mother in that instance would go ahead and title her assets to a revocable trust that would then distribute to a trust for her son at her passing.
Now, when you start talking about trust in general, They're number one, there are all kinds.
Correct.
Number two, you could choose to make a trust incredibly inflexible. You could dictate from the grave how much money they can take out of the trust and everything, or you can make a trust incredibly flexible, where it was really done to protect the brain surgeon, but it was not done to handicap him.
Right.
So now you have to begin to explain for people, a trust is nothing but a document. It's not a damn iron cage. You know, it's not, it can be incredibly flexible. Sometimes they can be resolved, dissolved. I mean, you can, you're looking to see whether it makes sense to use this particular vehicle and how much flexibility we want in the process.
Right, right. And so our advice generally is let's not hardwire in requirements into that trust. Let's not make it an iron cage, unless there's a really, really good reason to do that. Because what we do know is we don't know all the future is going to be. And so if we've got a trustee that we trust in place, and that's going to be critical, then we want to give them absolutely as much flexibility as they can have so that they can administer that trust for the benefit of the beneficiaries for whom it was intended.
Yeah, I mean, because now you also have situations out there. We have second marriages.
Right.
Where maybe you've gotten remarried 5 years ago, and you want the bulk of your assets to go to your children.
Right.
Not to your new spouse. So it's got to be designed accordingly.
It does. That's right.
I mean, in every one of those situations, it's potentially going to be different, isn't it?
It is, absolutely.
And I'm assuming you deal with a lot of blended families.
We do. We certainly do. And so a place to begin with a blended family is to make sure there is an understanding. Like if we're going to look at a will-based plan, we can't there's no guarantee that the surviving spouse is going to adhere to what that will-based plan was, because of course they could create a new will that completely cuts out their spouse's children. So we need to make sure those clients understand that well. So in a blended family situation, often a trust-based plan is what's going to make the most sense for them, because that way that trust that has the assets titled to it is going to be the controlling document, and we're going to be able to make sure that assets distribute where the couple intend for them to.
Yeah, and that's just a matter of figuring out kind of who's on first base. What are you trying to achieve? What are the goals? What are the objectives out there? And making sure that the individual you're dealing with understands what the options really truly are.
Right. Yeah. So our first job is educate the client. The decisions are the client's, and we want to make sure that they make informed decisions. They understand what their choices are and the consequences of them. And the client can make whatever decision they want.
And I would suggest too, I know not every situation is going to require this. The more communication the family has with the family member that's leaving the money, the better off you're going to be.
Yes.
I mean, the more surprises you create at your death, the more potential problems there are going to be.
Every time.
As long as everybody knows. And I would say the same thing for an executor of a will. Be a good communicator.
Oh, yes.
If you want to get yourself in hot water as an executor of a will or a trustee of a trust, don't communicate with the beneficiaries, and you'll find out
just
how poorly
how
it can go.
Oh, you're exactly right, Jim. That's exactly right. So communication is key, and that you've identified a really good point in time when it's key. When the person who's making the will at that time, go ahead and talk. You know, talk to your who you're leaving your assets to. Let them know what your intentions are, and talk to who you're not leaving assets to. Go ahead and let someone know. For these reasons, this is the plan I'm going to make.
And I'll tell you something else too. Ask whoever you're going to make the executor if they're willing to be the executor.
Yes.
Actually, have a conversation with them. Tell them where everything is. Write it all down.
Yes.
Put it in place.
And that's part of the reason for our questionnaires that you referenced earlier on. You know, that's where we begin to gather all that information. You know, we it's tedious to go through and to list every account and list the addresses for all of your family. But when we need it, we need it. And we're not having to, you know, rely on someone who's grieving, you know, later on to have to pull that information together. So we've got a good baseline. We've already gathered the information.
267-1023. Let's Talk Money. We'll be right back.
Let's Talk Money. Talk Radio 102.3.
You're back with Let's Talk Money. 267-1023. Stephanie Pego with me this afternoon from Shambliss, Bonner & Stoffel. All right, Steph, I want to ask you something. You referred to this and you used a technical term for it, but I can actually go in and do estate planning and I can set up a trust and nothing goes in it.
Yes.
Or I can set up a trust and put all the assets in it. What's the difference? I mean, one of it is just an empty box that's there when I pass away. It pours into the trust. The other way, I can actually retitle my assets and put them in the trust.
That's right. So if we go ahead and if we create a trust today and we go ahead and fund the trust, and that is title assets to the trust, then that trust is going to control and it's going to direct where assets go. So we're going to avoid the need to probate. Our trustee is going to be able to say, this is
now, this is where I could actually put the home in the trust. I could put the assets in the trust. I could make the beneficiary of a 401k the trust.
All those things.
I conceivably do all of those things where it's in place.
That's right. You sure can. And what you also could do is we could go through the same steps and we could set up a trust and nothing could end up titled over there. That would be a waste because we're going to need to probate then in order to fund the trust at the passing of the trustor. So we do want to go ahead and fund trusts if our intent
now,
is.
Well, let me back you up a second and say, okay, so now my wife and I go in there and we do the trust. We retitle all of our brokerage accounts in the name of the trust. Have we lost any flexibility or control whatsoever?
No, you have not. No, you have not.
It's no longer my name, it's in the name of the trust. If I'm the trustee of the trust, I'm in charge.
That's right. And is, let me kind of qualify that a bit. So if we're talking about revocable trusts and you and your wife are the trustee of your revocable trust, yes, you've got the same amount of control as if that trust really didn't exist because you're the beneficiaries of the trust and you've got complete discretion over how you spend
it. So when someone says the term revocable versus irrevocable, you better have a heads up.
Yes, you bet.
Because you are potentially given, when you say irrevocable, you are giving up a level of control more often than not.
That's right. That's right. And there are reasons to do that. There's reason to give up that control. And people especially think about an irrevocable trust when we're thinking about tax planning for them. So if there's the potential for their estate to be federally taxed and they'd like to not experience that, then they're going to think about how can I get assets out of my individual estate and so that they're not taxed.
And to legitimately get assets out of my estate that are no longer considered a portion of my estate in any way, shape, or form, I've got to give up control of those assets.
Exactly.
So I better be sure.
You better be sure.
And you better have some pretty big numbers. Most of the time.
Usually doesn't make sense to do unless you do have big numbers, but there can be other reasons why.
Are a majority of the trusts that you do revocable living trust?
Yes. If we're talking about just planning for someone, yes.
When you say revocable, obviously it means an individual could choose to revoke that trust while they're alive.
Oh, that's exactly right, Jeff.
When does a revocable trust become an irrevocable trust?
It becomes irrevocable at the passing of the trustor of the trust. So, and based on the terms of the trust. So if we have a couple and they've come in and they have a revocable trust, a joint revocable trust together, and Tennessee's got some great versions of revocable trust. One's a tenancy by the entirety trust, which can offer some extra creditor protection to the couple. One is a community property trust, which has a nice step-up in basis advantage to a couple. So anyway, under the category of revocable trust, the couple can then direct that upon the passing of the first spouse, the trust can become irrevocable at that point, or can become irrevocable passing in the second spouse.
Now, a lot of this does get into the weeds, but it does tell people, here's where your estate attorney is going to, historically, is going to be pretty accomplished. The type of trust I may need, and that may depend upon tax law.
Right.
It may depend upon who the heirs are.
Right.
I mean, so what this thing is going to look like, there's incredible flexibility on the design of this process, isn't there?
Flexibility and creativity and options. It's fun.
Yes. I mean, so in essence, the people that do this for a living do it for a living because they, in a majority of the case, they do it because they enjoy it. And in essence, in what they're listening for, it's no different than a good financial advisor. I'm listening for what it is you're trying to accomplish.
Right.
And I'm aware that what I really need to be communicating to you is stuff that you might not know.
Right.
Because in essence, what I have found, and I think you would say this too, that if you give clients all the information that they need to make a good decision, the huge majority of the time they're going to make a good decision.
That's right.
I mean, but they're there. If they're there and they're smart, they're asking for directions.
They're asking,
here's my entire set of circumstances. Let's use an example. You mentioned the term special needs. Special needs could be a lot of things. It could be someone with mental issues. It could be someone with Down syndrome.
Right.
It could be someone that's been diagnosed early onset with MS or whatever the case would be, where there may be a time frame that you realize that this individual will not be able to handle these assets by themselves.
That's right.
So what do you do in that situation?
Right. So what we do is we want to make sure we've understood from the family well kind of what are the goals for the person with the special need. What's life really looking like for them? And especially if a family is telling us, you know, we're not really sure what this person's going to need, and we're not sure if they're going to need to be on Medicaid and kind of get some services from the state.
So then maybe SSI-type benefits, and if you leave them a lump sum, you may destroy their ability to get the benefit or be eligible for certain programs.
Exactly. And so so families can think we're doing such a great service for this individual because we're going to leave them so much. But actually, that's going to be a detriment to them because that they could kick them off disability and then cause them to have to spend down, where we can do some great things for them by putting assets instead into a special needs trust such that the trust is there to provide what the state doesn't provide for that individual.
Now, there's a case where you've got potentially a medical issue involved. How about a situation where I've got two children? Adult children. One of them's awful with money.
Not one of your children, John.
No, I've only got one. She's pretty good with money.
I know.
But awful.
Yes.
How do you address that? Or maybe they had a drug situation at one time. Right. Maybe they're in a horrible marriage. There are certain things that you can look out to say, now we've got to either protect this person from somebody else
or
protect them from themselves. Yes.
Sure, absolutely. And so those are great questions. Those are what we're going to be asking families about. And then the way that we're going to be able to address that is through a trust. And so we're going to have language for that child that maybe it doesn't have good spending habits. We're going to make sure that we've got spendthrift language within our trust document such that child can't leverage the trust to pay debts or what have you. If we've got a child that's got, you know, other issues going on, we're still going to be able to protect that money in trust. We're going to give the trustee the authority to make distributions or not make distributions based on what's actually going on in the life of that individual, such that a distribution doesn't harm them. Now, a distribution can harm them if it's going to further bad choices that person's making, or if it's going to make money available to creditors that we don't want to do.
Yeah, you're looking for what the potential repercussions are. And every situation and every story that you're told creates a different set of red flags, potentially, doesn't it?
It does.
Because my impression that I get from all the years that I've dealt with you all is you are always looking at what can go wrong.
We are. And it seems like that makes us very pessimistic, upset people, but it's not true. We're just looking out for our clients, and just we've seen the one-offs. We've seen the things go wrong, and we just want to make sure that we're covering those bases for you. And most likely things are going to go just fine, or we'll be able to fix whatever it is. But we're going to make sure that we've looked at as best we can what all the contingencies are and thought about them so that we can make things go as smoothly as they possibly can.
Now, it would appear to me then there's a difference between, you said it, from a state administration to a state planning.
Right.
One you're planning, the other you're looking at when the game's over.
That's right.
And if you've been in the estate, if you've been in the administration arena, you're constantly dealing with what went wrong.
Most often, or at least there's an element of it. Sometimes we've planned for there to be an element of a state administration because we know that that's going to be the most
best
direct
route
line
to go.
Right. And so maybe like in the example you gave earlier where everything's going by beneficiary designation, and there's also a house. Well, we know we can do an abbreviated kind of administration called a monument of title, and we can handle the house so easily, and that's fine. And we meant to do that, and we meant to administrate the estate that way. And there's not a problem that way. But we sure can get sideways when, in the case of someone who didn't do any planning at all, and now we're administering an intestate estate, and we've got people that are all kinds of sideways, we've got problems, and it's...
Is it fair to say if you die intestate that it's going to court?
It's going to court, yes.
I mean, that's... You have now determined that the state of Tennessee is in control of this estate, and the legal system is really going to handle that, isn't it?
That's right, Jim, but let me qualify my answer just a little bit. If the person only had assets that went by beneficiary designation or were jointly titled,
then it wouldn't matter as much. Yeah.
Right, but their probate estate. So their probate estate is anything they own in their name alone, without beneficiary designation, without joint ownership, anything in their name alone. That's what the state controls, and so that if they haven't made a will.
267-1023. Let's Talk Money. We'll be right back.
Let's Talk Money. Talk Radio 102.3.
You're back with Let's Talk Money, 267-102. With me this afternoon, Stephanie Pedigo. Stephanie, what is a probate court? What do they do?
They administer estates a lot. So they're going to be there to kind of handle these kind of afterlife questions.
So in essence, a probate court, if I'm the executor of a will, and my brother passes away, I'm now the executor of the will, I have to go down to the court, and I have to get a letter of testamentary.
Correct.
And that tells the world that I'm now the administrator of the will.
That's right.
Fair to say?
That's fair.
So in essence, now so if you're a financial advisor and someone passes away, the executor of the will needs to come to us, and he needs to come to us with a letter of testamentary, because the custodian is not going to operate without a death certificate and a letter of testamentary that the court says XYZ is in charge.
Exactly correct.
So in essence, the probate court, to some extent, they're the court set up to handle this stuff.
They are.
And their expertise falls within the framework of estate plan in the aftermath. Having said that, why do I get the impression that probate is not that as big a deal in the state of Tennessee as it might be in other states?
We, in the state of Tennessee, I think we have a good streamlined process.
Much more so than some other states that we have had to deal with.
Absolutely.
Clients in those areas.
Where that's
it's,
right.
It's not, I guess what I'm saying is you don't necessarily, I would like to avoid it to the extent that I can, but I'm not completely fearful of that process either.
No, not at all. And there's benefits to the process, too. It's like you've said, I mean, what you're going to receive as the personal representative are letters testamentary, and that's your evidence to the world that you are approved and in charge of the estate. You might be bonded, and people can think, well, bonds seem like a scary or bad idea. Well, it's not. It's an insurance policy for you. That's okay. Also, we're going to give notice to creditors when we administer an estate. That's a good thing because it's going to cut off how long a creditor could bring a claim against the estate. And also, if a creditor brings a claim, we can object to the validity of that claim. And plenty of times were able to get claims dismissed from creditors, and that's a benefit to the estate. So, yeah, probate's not, it's not a terrible thing. It's not something to necessarily be avoided at all. But in our good planning, we just want to be thoughtful about what we're doing and if we mean to take certain things through probate or we don't.
I know we're going to run out of time, but there's going to be another situation. You go through a divorce, you need to redo your estate planning.
Yes, you do.
Right. I mean, that's not uncommon at all.
Not uncommon at all.
I mean, I had someone in here the other day, and they're going, oh, no, my ex and I, we've agreed to everything. There's no court involved. I'm going, I said, well, there's a $2 million 401k over here. The custodian is not going to split it without a qualified domestic relations order from the court.
That's right.
You don't get to write that up yourself.
No, you don't.
So there are going to be certain things that you're going to have to deal with this process.
That's right. And I mean, it's a really bad idea to not to. So like we talked about, you know, we don't want to have the situation of a divorce and then a remarriage later.
Stephanie, how do people reach you?
They reach me at Chambliss, Bonner & Stoeffel. My direct dial is 423-757-0235.
Thank you, ma'am. Appreciate you coming in.
Very welcome.
All right, coming up right now, Yaffe Live from 1 to 3, 3 to 7 Sports Talk. Have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.